This is podtech.net. I'm Jason Lopez at the 2006 Java 1 conference in San Francisco. In this podcast of the late morning general session, Sun engineer Bill Shannon rolled through a number of new features in Java EE 5. We've broken the speech into two parts. Here's part one.
So last year, I gave you a preview of some of the things we were working on for Java EE 5. This year, I'm happy to announce that Java EE 5 is done. So, Java EE 5 was approved by the JCP 2 weeks ago. Last week, we released the Java EE 5 SDK. What I'd like to do during this session is give you an overview of some of the new things we've added in Java EE 5, show you how easy it is to develop Java EE applications, and encourage you all to download the Java EE SDK and try it out yourself. Java EE 5 already has broad industry support. You'll be seeing Java EE 5 products from at least these vendors, many of whom already have versions that they can demonstrate for you. And of course, you'll also be seeing Java EE 5 support from your favorite IDE in the near future as well. Now, we all know that Java EE is very powerful. It's the industry standard for robust enterprise applications. But we've heard for years that it's just too difficult to get started with Java EE, even though simple applications need lots of boring boilerplate. And that boilerplate obscures the simplicity of the application and makes it more difficult to learn Java EE. This has been our primary focus for Java EE 5, to make it easier to develop Java EE applications, especially when you're just getting started with Java EE. We've taken a number of different approaches to making it easier to develop Java EE applications. We continue to use a declarative programming style. We've removed some requirements, and we've introduced some new frameworks. Now, Java EE has always used a declarative programming style, where instead of calling lots of APIs to get things done, you simply had to tell the container what it is you wanted, and the container did all that hard work of figuring out how to deliver that capability for you. Now, originally, we used deployment descriptors to communicate this declarative information to the container. In Java EE 5, we've added the ability to use Java language annotations to communicate this declarative information. We've also moved to more of a plain old Java objects or POJO programming style, which removes requirements on application developers. No longer need to understand lots of framework APIs and implement lots of interfaces that were defined by the platform. You can structure your applications the way that you want to, giving you more freedom over how you build your application. Along with that, we've introduced more cases where there's a default behavior. So if you say nothing in your application, you'll get a reasonable default that's provided for you by the container. And we've introduced some new powerful frameworks to Java EE that means that there's less work that you have to do to create an application. All these combine together to make it easier to learn Java EE for beginners and make it more productive for experts. One of the techniques we've used across the Java EE platform is Java language annotations. So we've made extensive use of annotations for defining and using web services, to map Java classes to XML, to greatly simplify EJB development, to map Java classes to databases, to specify external dependencies, and to reduce the need for deployment descriptors. Even with all these uses of annotations, we find that we're just starting to scratch the surface of what's possible with annotations. So I think you'll be seeing lots more uses of annotations in future versions as well. We've introduced several major new features to Java EE 5 in support of our goal of making it easier to write Java EE applications. We've simplified web services so that it's even easier to write web services in Java EE 5. And we've added support for more of those web service standards that are very important for interoperability. We've also introduced a new technique called dependency injection that makes it easier to deal with external resources that an application needs and reduces the need to use JNDI and deployment descriptors in many cases. We've greatly simplified EJB development by moving to a POJO-based programming model. And the EJB expert group has also introduced the new Java Persistence API that effectively replaces EJB CMP and makes it much easier to deal with persistent data in a database. And we've also introduced Java Server Faces to the Java EE platform that makes it much easier to develop sophisticated web applications. We've done all of this while remaining fully compatible with J2EE 1.4, so your investment in J2EE is protected with Java EE 5. So let's look at some examples of applications and how we've simplified things with Java EE. Here's an example of a web service the way you would write it with J2E 1.4. In the upper left of this slide, that's the implementation class for the web service. This is a simple hello service that echoes back hello to whoever calls it. And you can see deep down inside there is the actual business logic of this web service where it returns hello. Now, in addition to that implementation class, you also had to write a Java interface that corresponded to that implementation class to tell the container what the actual API was for the web service. Now, the Java code there, that's not too bad. You're probably familiar with writing code like that. But that wasn't all you needed to do. In J2E 1.4, you also had to do the stuff on the right, which is write these XML files that went along with the web service that told the container how to map all the Java artifacts in your web service to those web service messages that it was going to send. Now, here's what we've done in Java E5. That same web service written in Java E5 is just this code here. You start out with a simple class. It looks like a plain old Java object. You can see very clearly the business method in this class. All you needed to do to this class to turn it into a web service was add that web service annotation. That tells the container this class should be exposed as a web service, and the public methods on this class should become web service operations. Here is the client for Java E5 for that web service. Again, it's a plain old Java object, has a static void main method. Inside the main method, we're going to call that method on our web service. We have a variable that is the reference to the web service. We use the web service ref annotation on that variable. That will tell the container to fill in that variable with a reference to our web service. That's all we need in order to call the web service. Now, building that web service is a little bit more complicated. It's a little bit more complicated to build the client than it was to build the web service endpoint. The client actually needs the definition from the web service from the container where we deployed the web service. So we use the WS import tool to import those web service definitions for use in the client. So with the WS import tool, we give it the URL of the web service endpoint in the container that we just deployed. That imports all those definitions. After that, we can compile our class just like normal, package it together into a jar file, need to include a manifest to tell it what the main class is for our application. We can deploy this application client, and then using the app client command, we can run this application client. We say hello to Joe, and it echoes hello, Joe. So that was an overview of web services in EE. Web services are built on the JAX-WS and JAX-B APIs. They really form the basis of our web service stack. But you'll notice that we didn't need to know anything about JAX-WS or JAX-B APIs in order to build web services. But they're all there. They're supporting the web services for you, including the support for the greatest and latest and greatest standards, W3C standards like SOAP 1.2, MTOM, XML Schema. Those are all supported in our web services stack. Also supports the latest WSI standards for interoperability, so basic profile and attachment profile are supported there. And we're starting to support many of the WS star specifications, like WS security. We've got work going on for WS addressing and WS policy. You saw some of the demonstrations of some of this work earlier on today. We're going to continue to add more support for more of those WS star specifications in our web services stack. So JAX-B is a core element of the web services stack. You can also use JAX-B independently of web services. JAX-B is used to bind Java classes to XML schema. And JAX-B 2.0 has added support for 100% of XML schema. So any XML schema that you want, you can feed that into JAX-B and use that to generate Java classes to support XML, or vice versa. And JAX-B 2.0 has moved to an annotation-driven architecture, like much of the rest of Java EE5, which results in much more portable applications. And again, this provides that data binding layer for use with JAX-WS 2.0. So let's look at how we've simplified JAX-B. This is what you would get in JAX-B 1.0. If you give JAX-B 1.0 a schema that represents this simple XML file where you have a point with X and Y coordinates, you feed that schema into JAX-B 1.0, it was going to generate 308 lines of code in 38 different files, 219 kilobytes of total code generated for that simple XML file. You can see the code there on the left, or maybe you can't. But we simplified that greatly in JAX-B 2.0. In JAX v2.0, same XML schema fed in, it generates 62 lines of code in two files, and the code that's generated is just about the code you would expect to represent an XML document of that sort. You end up with a point class. It has getters and setters for X and Y, all pretty much straightforward code the way you could write it yourself. And it includes annotations that describe how this class is mapped to XML. So that was a great simplification in JAX V. EJB is another one of the things that we've greatly simplified in Java EE5. EJB 3.0, we've simplified all of the different bean types in EJB by moving to a POJO-based programming architecture. So this makes it much simpler. You don't need to understand all of those EJB APIs and EJB interfaces in order to write applications that take advantage of the power of the EJB container. We've also introduced more defaults into EJB. So for instance, if you're creating a session bean, the methods in the session bean are going to run in the context of a transaction. You don't need to say anything to make that happen. That's just the default behavior, which is most often what you want. The EJB expert group also introduced the concept of dependency injection that I'll talk more about later, and we've used that across the Java EE5 platform. Another feature introduced with EJB 3.0 is interceptors. This is a feature for more powerful applications so that they can intercept on all of the method calls into the EJB or all of the lifecycle events that happen to an EJB to provide value-added capabilities that way. Here's an updated version where we're going to use JDBC, and every time the method is called, we're going to keep track in a database of how many times we've said hello to the person that is we're calling the method with. So we use JDBC, pretty straightforward JDBC code. From the data source, we get a connection, create a prepared statement, execute the update command, close the connection. It's all very straightforward JDBC stuff. Anybody who's familiar with JDBC will recognize this. We did, again, use that dependency injection feature to get the data source initialized for us by the container. So that's not too bad, but we could probably make that simpler as well. By using the Java Persistence API, we can make things much simpler. Now, the Java Persistence API, that was developed by the EJB expert group. It's a new single persistence API for both Java EE and Java SE. So the Java Persistence API is part of Java EE 5. You can also use the same API outside of the Java EE context on just plain old Java SE. This new API is built on years of experience with existing technologies, so we're very confident that this is a good API. It's much simpler than EJB CMP. So if you're scared off by EJB CMP, please take another look at the Java Persistence API. We've also got three implementations of this API already. They all actually happen to be open source implementations. Oracle has contributed the TopLink Essentials implementation to Project Glassfish, which we're using as the reference implementation. JBoss has their Hibernate implementation, which is evolving to implement the Java Persistence API. And BEA has their Kodo implementation, which they've contributed to Apache for the OpenJPA project. So let's update our example to take advantage of the Java Persistence API. With the Java Persistence API, we use an entity manager to manage our persistent data. So in our say hello method, we call the entity manager and tell it, find me an instance of the person class for the parameter that was passed. If we can't find anything in the database, we create a new person, and we persist that back to the database. Finally, we return our result, and we're going to call the increment count method on that to increment the number of times that we've said hello to a person. So, of course, we also need that person class that goes with it. This is the actual persistent entity class. We identify it as a persistent entity by the entity annotation on the class. We also have to tell the database which of the fields of the class to use as the primary key of the database. We use the ID annotation to indicate that. Other than that, this is a plain old Java object. It has constructors, it has business methods, very familiar to you. In addition to that, we also need to have one XML file that goes with this persistent class to tell the container that this application has a persistence unit. But it's a very simple XML file. It's just these few lines of code where we define the persistent unit and give it an arbitrary name.